You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting to Yes And.
Dr. Stephen Heine is Professor of Social and Cultural Psychology at the University of British Columbia. His research focuses on how people come to understand themselves and the world around them. In particular, he studies how people's cultures shape how they make sense of themselves and their worlds, how people strive to find meaning in their lives, and how people understand genetic causes. He's the author of Cultural Psychology, which is a top-selling textbook in this field. And he has a new book. It's terrific. It's called Start Making Sense: How Existential Psychology Can Help Build Meaningful Lives in Absurd Times. Enjoy the pod.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch.
Stephen Heine, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks so much for having me here. Looking forward to talking with you.
All right. I want to start the conversation with a passage from a poem. We would rather be ruined than changed. We would rather die in our dread than climb the cross of the moment and let our illusions die. So you might think this poem was written today based on its content, but it wasn't, was it?
No, that's that poem was written in 1947 by the existential poet W.H. Auden. And he was describing what felt like a very similar situation to what we're in right now. Things feel really anxious right now.
Yeah, and the poem is called The Age of Anxiety. And you talk about the time we're in right now as a new age of anxiety. You say in the book, quote, everyone seems on edge now, and I don't know anyone who would disagree with that.
Yeah, there's just so many things happening to us. I mean, you know, the climate change is here. We might lose our jobs to AI. Everyone's stressed out on social media. And, you know, Thanksgiving dinner now with your family can, you know, feel about as tense as trying to defuse a bomb. There's so many things that we used to take for granted, that we used to think that everyone agrees on, we find out we no longer do. And this is creating a great deal of anxiety.
And yet, like in so many ways, it's never been better.
That's right. I mean, as poor as we feel now, I mean, if you just look back at time, if you look at the time when W.H. Auden wrote that poem in the middle of the 20th century, our incomes, the median income has over doubled. We have more leisure time than we used to. We're living a lot longer than we used to. They're as bad as prejudice is now, it was worse back then. By almost any measure that you could size up a society, we're doing better, but we feel so much worse. We feel that we're drowning in uncertainty and anxiety.
I was recalling a conversation I had with Morgan Housel, who's terrific finance writer primarily, and he talks about how in the past, when we would look across the street at our neighbor, they basically had what we had, so it didn't feel, you know, in fact, the income inequality gap was much smaller, but today, because of our devices, we're seeing all sorts of stuff
that creates
cognitive dissonance, right?
That's right. Everyone's life looks better than our own, right? We see, people are very careful how they curate it on social media. But yeah, we're not just comparing ourselves to our next door neighbor now. We're comparing ourselves to everyone else in the world. And we're always finding people who look much better than us. And yeah, this is creating a lot of status anxiety.
When I'm reading a book like yours, and doing my work, these worlds collide sometimes. So I want to talk to you about this thing that happened the other day. We held a workshop, a 2-day workshop with a bunch of our facilitators, because Second City takes its improvisational exercises and pedagogy into businesses all over the world to make people more effective communicators, better listeners. We work on the skills. And this workshop was about creating some new exercises. We're like, well, let's see if we can develop some new stuff. And my friend Jen came in. She goes, okay, I've got a title, basically a terrible title for an exercise that you now have to go create. Five different groups of two, and it was called Butter and Socks. And we're like, what are we going to do with this thing? So one of the pairs came up, and their exercise was two people sit across from each other, and I'm going to give you an item or an object or an idea, and he said greenhouse, and the other person's job was then to describe what that object wasn't. Just all the properties that don't actually belong to a greenhouse.
Okay.
And it's very similar to an exercise we have called point and untell, where we make people point at an object and then you have to say what it isn't. And this is a place to get you into divergent thinking. Now, the thing that happened after it, we're like, how does this tie up with butter and socks? Because after each of them participated doing this exercises, they slapped their knees 3 times and said, butter and socks, butter and socks, butter and socks. And the reason I was like, that's a very effective exercise, because what the butter and socks part of it is getting you in the state of play that takes you out of the unpleasantness of the cognitive dissonance.
Ah, yes.
Right? Maybe.
I see it. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, well, that points to what I do in a lot of psychological experiments is I'm interested in what happens to people when things no longer make sense. That generally we go through life and everything's working just as we expect. The vast majority of time, our expectations are being realized. But I think it's really interesting to understand, well, what happens when we're struggling with trying to make sense. And we've done this with some rather trivial ways of making things not make sense. So we play blackjack with people with cards that the colors are reversed, and people don't consciously notice this, but they're bothered somewhat. We've had people participate in magical tricks that they don't know they're in, where we swap the experimenter on them. Or we just have people sit down and watch a clip from a David Lynch film. And it's
That'll
and
do it.
yep, that'll do it every time. And so this creates this feeling. We think it's the uncanny is the label that we give to this feeling, where you realize that things just aren't making sense. You don't know what is happening around you. And then we find in our research that that motivates people to go and try to make sense a different way. And I think this is what we're facing more generally with all of the stress and uncertainty that we're experiencing right now. In many ways, our lives often don't feel that they're making so much sense. And this
Right.
is deeply bothersome. It's very corrosive to our well-being. And so we are looking for ways that we can go about and make more sense and more meaning into our lives.
The chapter two, and you talk about primatology, and there is just a fat. I mean, the whole chapter is really interesting, but you have this one section where you talk about the work of psychologist Jesse Baring. And you write in the book, quote, "Over the course of what amounts to centuries of meticulous observation by primatologists at hundreds of different sites, on no occasion has a distraught or ostracized ape ever been seen, for example, to climb to the highest branch it could find and jump. That's us. We're the ape that jumps."
That's right. Yeah,
Wow.
I think that's a great quote from Jesse Baring, and it highlights something that we're different. Chimpanzees are our closest relative, animal relative, right? We departed. We had a common ancestor maybe 6, 7 billion years ago, million years ago, something like that. And so something changed in this time where we used to be like other animals, where we're faced with these external threats we have to survive, parasites, predators, famine, and so on. And we still have that. But something changed that now we also have to cope with our inner demons, that now we have to manage these threats that come from inside of us, the threats that we feel when our life doesn't feel very meaningful, that we can't make sense of things, where we don't feel that we're living up to the standards that we have for ourselves. And this can create create a great deal of anxiety, unease, and in the worst case scenario, yeah, it could lead to suicide. And so, yeah, I'm trying to figure out, well, how is it that we became an existential ape, that we became an ape here that has to worry about these deep inner concerns about how to lead a satisfying and meaningful life?
So I'm curious for you, because you bring in Camus and the existentialists. Did you have a love of that work from as a young person like I did?
Not so much. I actually came to it from doing the research that I did. And actually, I had a grad student, Travis Prue, who introduced this to me. So I was just interested in, the psychological question, how is it that we make sense of things? And he pointed out to me, Albert Camus, and The Myth of Sisyphus, one of his books, where he really highlights this, that he calls it that humans have to deal with the absurd. That is, in Camus' view, the universe is a cold, meaningless place, but we are a creature that strives to find meaning. And every now and then we're reminded that our life doesn't make so much sense. And that's when we experience the absurd and this feeling that things just don't connect. And we really have a need to feel that they connect. We have a need for certainty. And this is one thing that we just can't really get used to is the feeling of uncertainty. It's deeply bothersome that our brains are designed to try to predict and control things. That's how we can navigate our environments. And uncertainty is what messes this all up. We have a sense that I don't know how to predict things. I don't know how to control things. And this is deeply bothersome.
Yeah, it's chicken and egg for me, right? Because I obviously, if I'm working in improvisational theater, we've got to be comfortable with the unknown because we don't have it. We're making it up in front of other humans, which is ridiculous to do. It seems insane. But it's always interesting to me that so many people who are drawn to this work are people who have social anxiety, who are on the spectrum. And in many ways, it's that moment where they need to be fiercely in the moment to do this thing, that's where they feel comfortable. And so it all feels of a piece a little bit. It's like it's in some ways, I think it's like, well, they're self-medicating through improvisation.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I do think that, people are attracted to these kinds of questions when they are wrestling with them in their own life. That some people really love David Lynch films, so where you the that feeling that you get where it feels like this isn't real, that are you in a dream? Nothing is making sense. And I think it's a safe place to go and explore those feelings, much in the same way that a horror movie does. It's a safe place to explore your worst fears. And I think, yeah, this literature, surreal film and literature is a place to explore our uncertainties and to feel that uncanny feeling that comes when things just don't seem to make sense.
Well, and this is also because we're storytelling creatures, right? We have to make up stories. This happens to me all the time where I will be, talking to my brother about some sort of memory, be like, that's not your story, that's my story. I'm like, oh, okay. I think we're semi-unreliable narrators, but we kind of have to do the storytelling. That's part of our meaning making.
Exactly. So this is the challenge for us, is that we want to feel that our life makes sense, that it's coherent, that all the different parts fit together. But in many ways, our lives don't always make that much sense. That, we can be quite different people in different situations. You might be a very, say, caring, doting parent, but then when you're driving in traffic, you become extremely rude and obnoxious, shouting to the other drivers. And you might be ambitious at work, you might be silly with your friends. So we have these different facets of ourselves. Sometimes we have these competing goals. We might have a goal to lose weight, yet we're sitting in front of the TV eating a pint of Häagen-Dazs. And, looking back at our lives, that, what we were doing in our earlier chapters of our lives might not relate that much to what we're doing now. How was I ever like that person that I was in high school? How does that person connect with how I am now? And so we have this challenge that we have ourselves have so many diverse aspects, but we have a strong need and desire here to make this all make sense, to make it all coherent. And the key way that we do this is we tell a story about ourselves. That this starts in around adolescence. That's where first people start telling life stories, where they start seeing how the different parts of their lives connect together. And these stories are very important to us. They form the foundation of our identity. And they're about, what we are doing, where we're coming from, why we're doing things, where we're going. And we want this story to be coherent and to make sense. And so whenever we encounter something, we're trying to fit it into this story. And the story isn't all necessarily all that accurate. It feels like the story that we're telling is true, that all these things happened. But the way that I'm going to relate what happened in our interview is probably going to be different than the way that you're going to relate what happened in our interview, right? That we don't necessarily see things the same way, even if we're looking at the exact same event. And so we tell these stories to make sense, and we're very dependent on having a story that we find convincing.
Can you talk a bit about the sort of I am good premise of the story, and maybe tell it through the story of Paul Frampton, because I had never heard about this guy.
Sure. In general, what I'm arguing is that the stories that we tell about our lives, they often share some common premises with each other, that our stories are actually quite similar. And one common premise in many people's story is the belief that I am good. And that is that you interpret the things that happen to you in your life in a way that you come out looking good. And Paul Frampton is a great example of this. He was a 60-year-old a theoretical physicist, and he found himself in an Argentinian prison. And what had happened that caused him to end up in prison was that he started texting with a woman who said that she wanted to get married and wanted to have children with him, and he was completely in love. Turns out this woman is a bikini model, world famous bikini model, Denise Milani. She never contacted him. It was some drug dealers actually contacted him and were posing as her. And anyways, in the end, he believed that this beautiful supermodel, 34 years younger than him, who he had never spoke to on the phone, was wanted to get married with him, and she just asked him to do a favor to carry this suitcase with him across across an international airport, and it was stacked full of cocaine, and he was arrested and up in prison. All of his friends told him, "This isn't real. This isn't happening. This woman is not real." From his perspective, this all seemed to fit. He said it seemed really plausible at the time that this is how we can interpret our situations to line up with this view that I am good. Now, in Paul Frampton's case, his view was a little delusional. A couple psychiatrists diagnosed him as having narcissistic personality
Yeah,
disorder.
that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, so it's a little more extreme than what most people do, but in principle, it's not all that different. That we, what we see in our lives, we're interpreting it through this lens that we're looking through, and it's for most people, it's a positively distorted lens. So that we remember our successes, we kind of fail, forget about our failures. When we do something well, we take credit for it. When something bad happens, we usually blame it on others. And it's by having this premise that I am good, that this shapes the way that we tell our life stories.
I know you're in Canada, but you might have heard that my state of Illinois has many governors who went to jail.
Yes, yeah.
Remember that Rod Blagojevich guy?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
All right. Well, he's my neighbor.
Really? Wow.
And we actually produced a show called Rod Blagojevich Superstar, and it was a big hit here before he went to
Wow.
jail. And he jogs down the center of the street.
Really?
And he has told himself a whole set of stories to justify all this kind of behavior. And when you're with him, it's like he is charming, and he it you get the sense that he believes what he is saying, and it's very disarming to be in the presence of that. And I think about that in the context of, and you talk about this, that there are some people who tell themselves that opposite story, that I'm not good.
Right.
Which made me think of Swan's self-verification theory.
Yes, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
So that's amazing to me. It's actually, when someone treats them badly, it scratches that itch, which is probably explains why people stay in bad relationships.
Right. Well, so I think this is a key point here. So that, and it just shows what our underlying psychological motivations are. Some people, don't have the premise, I am good, in their story. Instead, the premise that's guiding their life story is a commitment to the idea that I'm not very good at all. And remarkably, what a lot of research, especially by Bill Swan and his colleagues, have found is that people with this view actually prefer it when people are not nice to them, when people treat them badly. We found in our own research that people who have low self-esteem actually preferred bosses who were rather belittling to them, because this is sort of fit their understanding of themselves, that it feels like the world makes sense. I'm a bad person and people are treating me as if I'm a bad person. And that at a psychological level is curiously somewhat satisfying. That, and it shows how strong is our desire that we want things to make sense, even if they hurt our feelings in the process.
One aspect of when I started on this journey of reading a lot of literature and a lot of the contemporary science and working with the behavioral scientists, we did a program at the University of Chicago. The one thing I never would have guessed is how much literature there is around, or the science around, faking it to making it.
Yes.
It feels like that shouldn't be the case, but it keeps coming up over and over again.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And it's because, again, I think that we see our lives, we see what happens to us through the lens that we have. I call it a meaning framework of all our expectations about what is happening. It's our way of explaining things. It's the part of our story. And you're experiencing your life through this lens, you're going to start acting in ways consistent with that. And sometimes then that might actually change your life in a way to make those things happen more often. So if you can fake it till you make it often.
Someone once told me the key to successful marriages is that each partner thinks they're the one who won in that relationship. And that kind of connects. And you quote Nietzsche, who says, love is a state in which a man sees things most decidedly as they are not.
Yes.
This idea in relationships that kind of making that lie work is good for the relationship.
Yeah, I feel a little bad making this point because it seems to take the magic out of love. But a good loving relationship is one where we don't see our partners all that realistically and accurately, that we have a positive bias. It's not just that I am good, but my partner is good. And research by Sandra Murray and her colleagues finds that the most successful relationships are those where people view their partner a little better than what others would view them. And that this provides the foundation of love, so that you don't think, my partner is a slob. No, you think my partner's carefree. You know, you don't think, oh, my partner has temper tantrums. You know, no, you think he's very emotional, in touch with their emotions. And by framing what your partner does in these slightly biased ways makes them easier to love. Your life makes sense. It'd be much harder to feel love for your partner if you think about all the flaws that they have. And it's like, you know, here's my partner with all these flaws and I love them. That doesn't make any sense. Why would I love someone with all these flaws? So instead, we see our partners the way we want them to be. And those who can do that on average tend to have more satisfying relationships.
We should also probably note that in terms of cultural psychology, that this isn't the same for all societies. And in particular, you talk about the weird group of which you and I are part of. So why are we weird?
Yes. So weird is a label that my colleagues, Joe Henrich, R. and Oren Zion, and I came up with to describe Western educated, industrialized, rich, democratic samples. And these are the people that social science knows very well, because these are the people that most of social science has studied. the vast majority of the rest of the world really hasn't been studied to that same degree. And this is a problem because our psychology actually is shaped a great deal by our cultural experiences, including this belief that I am good, this key premise in many people's stories. A lot of research that I have done in Japan, I spend a lot of time in Japan, and I compare Japanese with Americans and with Canadians, and we find where this desire to see yourself as good is very pronounced, very reliable among North Americans. In Japan, it's something different. In Japan, people are more concerned with maintaining a sense of face rather than maintaining a sense of self-esteem. And maintaining face is different, and that requires other people to think positively of you, requires other people to think that you are living up to their expectations. And a good strategy to maintain face is to take a very self-critical look at yourself. Think of how might I have any shortcomings, or where might I be at risk for jeopardizing the positive view that others have of me, and then work towards correcting those. So we find our Japanese participants are very sensitive to their weaknesses. They attend to those, and they work to try to correct them, whereas our American participants are much more sensitive to focusing on their successes and what is good about themselves.
It's interesting. We worked pretty extensively in Japan with the entertainment group Yoshimoto, and we were teaching. So it's primarily comedy duos there, very old school, like you think of Abbott Costello. It's high status, low status person. And we're trying to teach them how to sort of do American style improvisation, which was the older artist did not care for it. And the younger ones loved it and were very interested in it.
Interesting.
And I love, but it's like, and you talk about this, that, the cultures are so different with regard to like things like choice. And I think it's maybe a friend of yours, a professor who would want his coffee a certain way.
Yes. So, choice is something that it's a key motivation that we have. Motivation chooses something that the existentialists argued was so important in life, that we get to choose our own lives. But not every culture celebrates choice the way that Americans do. And I think Starbucks is a great example. I think it's the temple of choice in the world, in that they promise that they will make you the drink the way you want it. And you can specify that, you want, a half caffeinated, grande, dark roast, warmed up 1.5 extra degrees, with some chocolate sprinkles on it, and they'll make it just the way you ask. But in Japan, they don't emphasize free choice to the same extent. And an American friend who is an instructor at a university in Japan, and he likes his coffee this one particular way. He likes to have 3 shots of espresso over ice in a glass filled up with milk. And the coffee shop in his town there wouldn't sell it to him. And he pleaded with him. He said, I'll pay you any amount you want. And they said no. And the reason they said no was because it wasn't on the menu. So he went to his class. He taught English at the college, and he went to this class and was complaining about Japan's lack of freedoms. And someone in the class told the manager of the coffee shop about this, and the manager wasn't happy with this. So she arranged a compromise with him. He would stop complaining about Japan and her coffee shop, and then every time he went to the coffee shop, they would give him a cup with 3 shots of espresso and ice filled up with milk. But it was only available to him. They programmed it into the cash register. They trained the staff. They let him name it. It was called the Captain. And so they made this special arrangement just for him, so he could get the coffee the way that he wanted. But he was still frustrated after all of this because he thought they missed the point. The point wasn't that they should make an exception for you if you complain enough. His point was you should always be able to get what you want, that you should have that kind of freedom. And in Japan, you don't get those kinds of freedoms. They usually try to make things that they think most people will like, and that's what's provided to you. And usually it's a really good option, but it's something that they don't celebrate choice to the same degree. And that's something that I think, especially in the U.S., even more so than in Canada, you celebrate choice. I mean, that's why you frame like political debates on things like, are you pro-choice? Like emphasizing the choice side of it, just because that sort of is this value that is so dear to the culture. But it's not celebrated the same way everywhere.
You taught me something else in this chapter. So I have been ordering the omakase when I go to a sushi restaurant every single time. I had no idea what it actually meant.
Yeah, it means leave it up to you, and you can use it in a variety of situations. But in a restaurant, it's yeah, leave it up to the chef. And that's kind of the when I'm in Japan, I really like going taking this omakase attitude. And yeah, you why do I have to make all the choices? Leave these choices up to someone else. And there's trade-offs with going omakase because you don't get to have your specific desires met, but you're spared a lot of the costs of making choices. And I think this is something that people don't always appreciate because we celebrate choices. Choice is great, but with choice comes responsibility. And if your life is based on all the choices that you've made, then you're responsible for all that your life has turned out. And so that having this freedom to choose any kind of life, it can create a lot of anxiety. So Kierkegaard said anxiety is the dizziness of freedom. Just knowing that it's up to us, that there's no set route mapped out for you. We need to figure it out for ourselves, that this brings a lot of responsibility and a lot of anxiety to us.
I wasn't expecting the book to go in the direction it did when you talked about how life will break our stories. And it was very personal for me because I've had a tragedy in my life and have very much sort of examined, what that did and how it played out. And that's when I learned about post-traumatic growth and those sorts of ideas. So talk a bit about the work you've done in that area.
Yeah, in our research, I'm interested in what kinds of ways that people are able to maintain the stories that they have in their life, what ways they're able to maintain a sense of meaning. And one thing that can really disrupt our sense of meaning is traumatic life events when they happen to us. And traumatic life events are devastating to us for two separate reasons. One reason, the way everyone understands them, is because we lose something precious, right? We might lose, say, a loved one, or we lose some capability that we have, and this is so devastating. But there's a second way that traumatic life events are hurt us so much is that they also completely upend the meaning frameworks that we have about what life is like. That we tend to go along thinking that, oh, good things happen to good people, that the world is a benevolent place, and that as long as I just am careful, I'll be able to take care of things. And all of a sudden, traumatic life event happens, and you realize that the world is not like that at all. And so this key sort of overarching framework for how to lead your life has been upended. And so a very common experience immediately after trauma is that people feel that things just don't make sense anymore. It's not just that I've suffered from these horrible losses, but now I also don't know the way forward anymore, that the world doesn't seem the way I thought it was. And so, yeah, this is one of our more profound kinds of meaning threats that we sadly encounter in life is through our sufferings, through these events that we are trying to avoid, but we in the end we can't avoid them.
You know, what's so interesting to me about that is that so much of our art does talk about that, right? I mean, that is a central theme of opera and literature and film. And the thing, we lost our daughter to cancer, and the thing that we were very public about it, and suddenly people were sharing all their traumatic stories with us. I'm like, no, and so many people have I speak all over the place, and people always will come up and talk to me about this, and it's like, so we know to experience it culturally, and that we need to understand this, but we don't share it personally, and that surprised me. And I don't know if that's I mean, I guess there's science to back up why we wouldn't self-disclose and all that, but it just seems like eons of life we haven't figured out that we need to share those stories personally.
I think one So as I was saying, traumatic life events can disrupt your meaning. But as you're just saying here, though, that reaching out to others and hearing other people's stories, that trauma, we can grow from trauma. And this is an rather underappreciated fact that most people, after suffering from trauma, it doesn't happen immediately after you're dealing with this huge meaning threat, but they do ultimately grow from it. And they grow from it because of you reach out to people, you also depend upon others in ways that you hadn't before and deepen your connections with others. People often develop more spiritual connections at the time, which also help to boost a sense of meaningful life. They realize that they have some inner strengths that they hadn't known that they hadn't come to the forefront before, and they also often get involved in new, they have new purposes that they often want to do more charitable work towards others who are suffering, as they have. So, as trauma is horrible, and we and you know. We do our best to avoid it, but sadly, in the end, we can't avoid it. This is comes with that's the price of admission with life. But at the most common situation for people, though, is that they do come to grow from it. They learn from it, and it deepens their sense of meaningful life.
Yeah, I thought what was interesting too here in this chapter is that sort of the polar opposite of meaning is not a thing like trauma, but actually boredom.
Yes, exactly. Boredom is one of the most corrosive forces for feeling that you have a meaningful life. When you are bored, what you are doing, you're unable to connect it to anything that you care about, and you're just left in the state of feeling alienated, and have no desire to do what you're doing. And boredom is really painful. This is, I think, industrialized societies, we're clever at coming up with a way of punishing people for their crimes, is they put them in a very boring situation. They put them in prison for, many, many years where they struggle with their boredom. And people hate feeling bored. It serves a useful signal. What boredom signals is what you're doing now is the wrong thing you should be doing. It's not providing you any sense of purpose or meaning. So you should be doing something else. So it prompts you to try to do something else. If you're not doing it, when people are bored, this is when to escape boredom. This is when they do a lot of really bad things. That they will. This is when they are more likely to engage in substance abuse, more likely to pursue, sort of harmful, just short-term sexual conquests or big gambles or risk-taking, just to escape this very unpleasant feeling of boredom. And so, yeah, that's what the feeling is signaling, is that what you're doing right now is unsatisfyingly meaningless to you, and you need to find something else.
You wonder why we've had and have in our culture all these ways of escaping boredom. And you talk about the things that people do less of now, like hanging out with their relatives, having dinner together, having a religion, going bowling or bowling leagues, things like that. So there's this long list of things that are all, ways to fight boredom, and instead, we're on our phones and scrolling through, and it's making us sad. It's you know I don't it's just such an odd thing, right? There's these screens everywhere that we go, and they're not helping us.
No. And I think this is what's at the root of why we feel so on edge these days, and why we feel so anxious, is that the feeling that life is meaningful is a mindset that helps us to cope with anxiety. It helps us to cope with uncertainty. It's such an important mindset to have. But what we now there's been a few decades worth of scientific research on what underlies meaningful lives, and we have a better understanding of that now, and what the kinds of things that predict whose life will be meaningful is first having close, satisfying relationships, spending time with close others, especially when you take on a caretaker role, when you're taking care of someone, taking care of a pet, taking care of a child, taking care of an elderly, that provides you with a sense of meaning. A second key kind of connection that provides us with meaning is feeling connected to a community, where you belong to a group and you have some sense of shared identity. And a th third kind of connection that's important is the connections with our work, where if you can see your work is providing you with a sense of purpose and a sense of mastery, then your work feels more meaningful to you. And fourth is the idea of feeling connected to something that transcends us, that feeling some spiritual connections in our lives, that these are especially potent sources of feelings that life is meaningful and feeling that in the grand scheme of things that you really matter. And all of these kinds of connections have been under assault for the past couple of generations, that we are seeing our close relationships less than we used to. A lot of it being because we're distracted by screens. We're less likely to belong to communities. We're less likely to, play bridge with the neighbors on the weekends or belong to a bowling league or belong to like a Rotary Club or the PTA. This used to be a big part of people's lives, and it no longer is. And people's work there, on average, they're deriving less of a sense of meaning from it because one, that people are changing jobs more frequently. They often have a few side hustles that they're cobbling together to earn an income. So they don't really have a sort of a sense of belonging to an organization. They might be working remotely and sort of not having colleagues. And then we're all worried about AI taking over our jobs. And then also with these spiritual connections, that these have been slowly being undermined over the past a couple of generations. More and more people are leaving organized religion and are losing the existential benefits that spirituality and religion provide us, that they provide us with this sense that our lives matter in the grand scheme of things. So we've been going for the past couple of generations. We really have been, we can see evidence that these key connections that make up a meaningful life, that, I mean, I think what a meaningful life is it's a richly connected life. And that these key connections are being undermined, and that's making us that much more vulnerable to handling all of the stressful experiences that we face. In many ways, as you're saying earlier, things have gotten better. We're living longer. We have more money, but we're so stressed because we no longer have that sense that we're grounded, that we have this existential grounding where we're connected to the things that matter in our lives. Rather, we're distracted by what's on our phone.
This makes me think, some time ago, I was talking to Nick Epley at the University of Chicago. We were having lunch and, I was having a bad day or whatever. And he's like, I have a solve for that. You should do something nice for someone. That's if you're in a bad mood, go do something nice for someone. And last week, I got a text from my friend Annie, who worked here in the box office and did nannying for us, and her girls, who are teenagers, they had a friend who over Thanksgiving went into heart failure, and she lived, but it was related to chemo that she got when she was a baby because she had had cancer.
No.
And Annie's like, look, she's obsessed with Seinfeld. She goes, I don't know if you know anyone, from the cast who would do a video. I'm just, of course, if you can't, I totally understand. And I took a moment. I'm like, well, I do know this guy, John. I don't know him that well, but we've texted. And I know he's friends with Jason Alexander. So I text him. I go, don't feel you have to do this, but just th this is what the scenario is. And 10 minutes later, I got a video from Jason Alexander. That was
Wow.
not just a, 30 second. It was about a 6 minute, like really talking to this girl and talking about how a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend reached out. And maybe at the end he goes,
Oh.
maybe this friend of a friend of a friend will introduce me to you in person when you're through all this. And it was
Oh, that's
just
nice.
so inc and I drove home that day. It wasn't so much like I felt good that I was able to help, but it wasn't just me doing the helping, right? It was so many
Right.
people in this line, and it was
Right.
all bigger and better than any of
Yeah.
us. And it was like I hadn't had that meaningful of a moment in a while.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great story. Yeah, and I think just showing how all of these connections that you relied on here is what helped make this meaningful. That you were helping a friend, that this friend was helping this person, and Jason Alexander coming out to help. Like it just meant so this event, which used to maybe just be something that this one woman was experiencing, is now sort of shared among so many other people who are caring about it. And so that's how I think, these. The more we're connected to something, the more connections we have, the more meaning we derive from it.
All right, this seems like a good place to ask for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yes, if I understand the nature of the
The
question, right?
assignment,
I had, when I was an undergrad, I had started off in business school, and I ultimately decided to switch to psychology. And in doing so, the university told me, you need to take a language course. And I was really annoyed by this because I was having to make up all these extra credits for switching, and I didn't know how I was going to fit this language course into my schedule. So I was really opposed to it, but I had to do it. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to take Japanese, just because I've always thought Japan is kind of interesting. And this just changed my life. That right away, even just in Japanese class, it felt like this whole different world, just dealing with the Japanese instructor. And I made it the minor, my minor at university. I taught English in Japan for a couple of years. I've lived there on numerous occasions. My first wife was Japanese. My kids are half Japanese. I do research on Japan. I go there almost every year. It's become this huge part of my life, and it all started with something that I was really quite opposed to doing. So I'm so happy that the university had this rule and that they made me take Japanese language course.
That is a perfect yes and story. The book is called Start Making Sense: How Existential Psychology Can Help Build Meaningful Lives in Absurd Times. Stephen Heine, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Kelly. It's a lot of fun.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Soul screaming atop of their lungs.
survive.